We're talking with Charles Ausman, all hail King Nerd. But a guy knows what he's talking about, both for where we are now, looking back to the past to see where we're headed for the future and how we can live it now. Next on Coast to Coast Live, this is Ian Punnett. You can link up to Charles Ausman at coasttocoastam.com. Check out some of the graphs that he's got up there, help explain the conversation that we're having. Charles Ausman, lecturer, historian of the future, Amish and, basher.
And yes. King Nerd, yes, indeed.
And
actually, I wanted to just toss in a very, very dear friend of mine who I've known for years, a wonderful woman by the name of Sally Richards. She tried to call me as I was about to go in the air, and I kind of yelled at her slightly, just say, don't call now if you can. But I wanted to bring it up because she's actually writing a book called The Talking Dead, and it's an interesting book. It's a kind of a Wiccan, nanotech, futuristic, sci-fi, feminist adventure novel with a kind of a techno twist that I actually am the sort of King Nerd in this book.
So you're a character.
I'm a character in this book, and she's been quietly writing this thing. And you know, so anyway, I just wanted to toss it out there. So your references weren't that far off, actually.
And frankly, I'd like to hear more about Wiccan tech sometime, too.
There's a lot to be said. But another one of my friends, who's a PhD from UC Berkeley, is a very serious practicing Wiccan. And in her view, she's also an author. Her name is Carolyn Stewart. And her vision is that we have the capacity to utilize our focused intent to proactively change our future. And I actually agree with her. I think there's a very serious thread between the world of quantum physics and biophysics and consciousness. And there's actually people who are practicing something called Diksha, which is an Indian version of this kind of concept, who are trying to actually articulate this process as we speak.
Will that lead us back into a discussion of spiritual intelligence later on?
Yes, that would be the case.
Well, then we'll hang on to that for now, and we'll come back to that. Because we were talking about the cosmids and the Therans, this belief that we're heading to some sort of juncture in our future where there's going to be a lot of worker bees and very few people who will be enjoying the benefits of the hive, so to speak. They will be those people that evolve using a kind of living techno brain that's going to do what for them? How is that going to inform their life?
Yeah, well, this is where it gets a little fuzzy because there's several pathways that could go, but one pathway, which could be the case, and in fact, you're tapping into another paradigm. There was a very famous book that was written a number of years ago called The End of Work, and I'm trying to remember the author's name. I've got it here someplace. But
that would be my brother. That would be my brother wrote that book.
No,
he wrote it to my mother.
He's one of the other big futurists. It wasn't Paul Sappho, but it was one of his sort of colleagues that wrote this book. And he kind of predicted this idea that said, look, if we end up in this sort of nano-futurism world, then, I mean, the actual purpose of physical labor might become moot, and what do you do with millions and billions of people that essentially don't have much to do? I mean, that's kind of, he was kind of making a bit of a facetious argument, but I mean, I could sort of see where he was going. And in a sense, if you look at the way that jobs are changing, the whole idea of repetitive sort of hand labor kind of work, I mean, you know, in China, maybe that's still sort of the thing, but there really is a trend, certainly in other parts of the developing world and certainly here, where that becomes less relevant for people who can think, who can imagine, who can creatively inspire new ideas. I just came from a conference that was sponsored by NTT here in the Bay Area. It was a kind of a creativity conference. It's kind of hard to explain this in a few words, but that was the idea. They were trying to articulate sort of the science of creativity. A lot of very smart people are kind of getting the sense that it's, you know, the more repetitive, the more kind of meat and potatoes the task, probably the less relevant humans will be in a near future place. I mean, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with displaced people who no longer plug into a world that up until recently still found some relevance for what they did? And it sounds kind of harsh, but I don't mean to sound that way. I'm just saying that this is an evolutionary challenge. And for a lot of folks who are trying to sort out where they're going to be going in their lives, like kids in college, for instance, I do a lot of guest lectures at various schools, I try to really bring this point home. It's not how well can you replicate something or perform some kind of preordained task. It's really how well can you create. That's going to be the highest commodity for people who want to market their skills or market their abilities. And I think that in the future, where we're kind of going is this idea that in order to do things, for instance, in the financial markets, in very, very complex areas of risk analysis, financial systems analysis, certainly in a lot of military situations. I won't go into that too much, except to say that in highly complex, you know, theater of war simulations, all that kind of stuff, but it kind of breaks down into even social patterns, things like advertising and trying to predict how people respond to, say, political information, all that kind of stuff. These things are becoming ever more kind of going into the world of other forms of intelligence beyond human to determine how these highly complex systems can be nudged or sort of pushed to a new dimension that could not be possible through just traditional human efforts. And we're becoming ever more dependent on that kind of a process. So there is a kind of a co-evolution as we speak, but the trend is going to be ever more aimed at where the highest value is, where the highest valuation index is on that creativity side.
Mm. In fact, as you're talking, and I was making some notes, I was reminded of the thing that you heard in the first hour where we were talking about random lines from Star Wars that might describe your sex life, right?
Yes, indeed so.
Okay. So as
some
I'm
of them
writing,
could apply to me. I already get that, yeah.
No. So I'm writing down some of the things you're saying, and I realize random lines from Charles Osman that might describe your sex life.
Okay, you know, maybe my friend Sally Richards could read this in her book.
Let me give you some that you just
Please.
Said. It's like risk analysis. Charles Osman says that might sound like your sex life. It's not how well you can replicate, it's how well you can create, which I
like. Okay, thumbs up, I got you.
It's like a theater of war simulation.
<That's good. laughs> That one I might approach a bit more cautiously. I'm not sure.
And the science of repetition. Well, anyway, so if you look at this, when you look ahead, if you had kids, say, who were going into college,
sure.
What would you start advising them? What would you nudge them toward in order that they be in a better position then to be one of the haves as opposed to the have-nots?
Yeah, exactly so. And that's what I was hoping to allude to as my previous statements. And by the way, Jeremy Rifkin, that's the author I was thinking of. He's the one that wrote End of Work. And he also wrote the Global Brain series. He wrote actually two books, The Global Brain and The Global Brain Continuum. So, I mean, Jeremy Rifkin's another one of these authors that's kind of well-known for this sort of thinking. But where I would go, in fact, when I give my talks at various schools, the thing I try to really harp on is the idea that people who can invent or see things that are not exactly the norm, in other words, you get trained in one of the technical skills or one of the sciences or maybe something in the liberal arts, depends on where you want to go, but it's really the ability to invent and see new patterns or see new interconnections in ways that perhaps weren't necessarily apparent at a previous time. A very heavy emphasis towards systems level recognition, a kind of a holographic cognition, as I call it. And that really is where the future is going. So for anyone who's entering, I don't care if it's in the biotech field, material science, medical, some form of media, art, whatever it might be, it's that kind of system-level recognition of how things fit together. I think that's where the highest premium is going to be.
I like that idea, where things fit together. Is everything going to fit together?
That's the real challenge. That's exactly what we're trying to wrestle with as we speak. And when I do my work at the Institute and we, write these reports and look at all these different complicated things, that's what I keep coming back to is, can this puzzle be made to fit, yes or no? And I'm going to toss out a statement now, which I'm sure will probably not only cause me more illness next Easter, but probably simply even more dire. But whatever it is, I mean, here's how I see it.
You're not going to blame it on the Amish again, are
you? No. The Amish are some of the most beautiful, pleasant people on the planet. Okay. I wish there were more of them. I mean this quite seriously, and your point was very well taken. In a certain type of fundamentalist way of looking at the world, in very basic concepts of doing the right thing, be right to your fellow man, honor your local community, don't harm people, try to do the better thing. I completely and 100% support that. That is what the spiritual path was supposed to have highlighted. Sadly, though, in many cases throughout the world, some cases Christianity, some cases Islam, there's other variations. Something very different and much darker has come out of this, where it's a competitive, predatory, very narrowly confined, very rigid kind of blind belief, our version of God is better, and you will now die in the service of that defense of our belief. And people who use these people for their own political purposes are probably the worst, most evil charlatans on the planet because they are taking advantage of people who are not necessarily evil in their own sense, but they believe blindly in a paradigm that's been forced upon them since birth in many cases. And then the rulers who choose to use them as pawns for their political gains use them that way. Except now there's a dramatic difference. Now we are in a world where you can't see one of the major weapons in past times has always been population. In other words, if I can grow my population faster than yours, I will dominate. If I can put more soldiers in the field, I will dominate. If I can control more land, I will dominate. If I can conquer your trade routes or in some way blockade your shipping or just whatever that might be, I dominate. And all those things really depend on lots of expendable people. And I mean, you know, it sounds kind of callous, but that's really what it boils down to. So in a certain kind of way, this paradigm, which has worked very well for thousands of years, when the planet could absorb a certain level of messiness, you might say, sort of abuse. In other words, you could kind of do a lot of bad things, but the planet would kind of get by and there would be enough people to kind of replace the ones you've killed off and all that kind of thing. Now, all of a sudden, we've come to a very different kind of world where those kinds of mechanisms, even though they were very tried and true for millennia, just are not going to work in a world where suddenly the population is spiking almost out of control. Plus, you now have matched this kind of predatory fundamentalist mindset with nuclear weapons, biological weapons, you know, all kinds of horrible things. This is a very horrible mismatch of realities. And in fact, it will be, this is the one thing that I think will prevent us from otherwise being able to come to a much better, much more viable sustainability equilibrium point. If we can't unravel this millennium old sort of fanatical way to shape people's thinking so they can be manipulated to fulfill these kinds of objectives, then all bets are off. That to me is the ultimate wild card. We either fix that or it's all bets are off.
Talk to me about scientific fundamentalists.
Well, actually, you are right. And in fact, another example, if I may, in the medical world, for instance, excuse me, there's a huge kind of a strange brew bubbling in the background where you have enormous pharmaceutical companies and their enormous investments, and they've, you know, very much been wired into a protocol that's very much wrapped around pumping their pharmaceuticals into the market, and they, in a sense, sort of pay for all the big medical schools to do their kind of research. I mean, I don't mean to sound completely negative, but I mean, there that kind of overview.
I'll go with you.
But let me offer some alternative thoughts. In a very sad way, a longtime friend of mine, Mitch Lobel, who's a guy who's known around the Bay Area, he's because of something called the Tech Startup Connection. It's a kind of a think tank for people doing high-tech startups. His wife just passed away from leukemia a few months ago. Very, very sad. These are some of the most nice people you could ever hope to meet. And it was very sad. But anyway, so in his research to kind of figure out, because his wife went through the very worst, the chemo and the whole thing, and I saw a little bit of this. So in his quest to find a better way, he hooked up with this British doctor, Dr. Mayan, who I've been talking with a little bit myself, and they came to me and said, "Hey, Charles, look, you're not a doctor, you're not a medical doctor, but we know that you know things about nanotech and how to build, you know, how to engineer stuff." So what they came up with is said they want to be able to monitor the electrical signals produced by the blood cells in the bone marrow. And the reason they want to do this is because it's Dr. Mayan's belief, and I guess some of his colleagues have a similar thought, that if they can detect a difference in the electrical information coming from those cells which are cancerous, because leukemia is a type of blood cancer, then they can, in a sense, target those cells or affect their behaviors before they ever leave the bone marrow. So what they approached me to do was, can I design or help to design a kind of a device that could be implanted directly into the bone to do exactly this, to monitor those signals and possibly affect the physiology of these leukocytes before they get into the bloodstream. Now, what's interesting is this is so completely different. This is way off the grid. If you look at all the major leukemia sort of research sites, and again, I'm not castigating folks, I'm not giving bad press to the doctors who are doing, you know, very good work, but they are kind of almost singularly devoted to a very specific kind of research. You know, we go to use drugs and go use chemicals and kind of use a very traditional pharmacology kind of approach. These folks are saying, you know, maybe there's a different way to approach this. And what's interesting, what makes this point relevant, is that 5 years ago, if this kind of a thing had happened and a British doctor came to me and said, "Hey, Charles, can you design a device that will do X?" I would have said, "Well, it's theoretically interesting, but I have no idea how to do this." In today's world, no longer the case. You can, in fact, sit down and draw a blueprint and essentially work out an engineering paradigm that says, yeah, we probably could build a probe like this and probably could have these types of devices. In other words, we have a toolbox available to us as we speak, which is so radically different than what was available, say, even 5 or 7 years ago, that it completely changes, in many cases, radically changes, the whole concept of what medicine even is or might be in the near future. So that's like one narrow example of that.
Okay, but again, you know, I mean, some of what we've seen already in the advancements of medicine is the ability to do something is so far ahead of the curve of our ability to understand whether or not we want to do it. And so we're caught in that discrepancy between the technology or the knowledge of, say, the preservation of life. Keeping somebody alive is not a problem. We've yet to come to terms with whether or not we want to.
Yes, and that's actually, Ian, that's a wonderful point. Thank you, because I really wanted to bring that up. That's a very excellent point. Two things to be said for this. First of all, not to get too far off into the political thing, but I really feel extreme discomfort with the current administration and their sort of theological doctrine that they tried to use to as a template by which to measure science in all different areas, including medical. I mean, stem cells is kind of like one example. But I'm saying, I think where you're going, if I could be that preemptive or presumptive, is that you're saying we should have choice. We should have the ability to determine for ourselves where that dividing line should be. Now, speaking for myself, if I get to a point where I'm truly hooked up to life support and I'm kind of old and crumpling and, you know, kind of painful every minute, I want to have the option. I want to be able to, with a blink of an eye or a press of a button, say, okay, it's my time, and I'll, you know, peacefully go, and that's it. Now, I would not want to enforce it upon somebody else, but I would certainly want to have that choice for me. And I think this is really where we have to kind of take back, if you want to look at it from a political perspective, the rights of people to determine what is a right for them, rather than have some kind of theologically sculpted template thrust upon them saying you will be allowed this and not allowed that because it doesn't bode well with the, you know, current religion du jour. I find that extremely unpleasant.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's interesting. No, I wanted to hear where you were going to go with it. So I wanted to see as you were going to follow the trajectory of my thought thus far.
Okay, sure. My apologies.
But I guess in a way I'm sort of challenging you again on this. Because you made an interesting point about, you know, technology in the hands of fundamentalists, technology potentially earth-ending technology the hands of people who just as well believe in another world, and so therefore ending this world means nothing to them.
Yeah.
But then I challenge you to say that there are many people within science who are in the same extreme – have the ability to do something and want to do it because they can.
Yeah,
and
I agree with you. I will absolutely agree with you that there are some folks in science, and I mean this in a very delicate kind of way because I am sort of academic, so I have to be sort of careful. But I think that sometimes people get so impassioned by the research and they've been trained to such a specific area of specialization that they kind of see this very small dot.
Right.
And they say, that's the dot, and I'm going to get there, and I'm going to get there first because the Nobel Prize is the thing, or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, that can happen. And there is a kind of a myopia that sets in, which may not be quite as severe as the kind of religious myopia, but it certainly is that kind of a thing. And I agree with you. There's a balance between those two extremes.
And that's part
of the challenge.
And that's what I was getting at about the idea about keeping people alive. I don't know that it's a matter of fundamentalists or this current political climate or anything. It's sort of like we can do something and then we figure out afterwards whether we really want to. And I think we're not equipped really to handle some of the things we're able to do.
And that taps into spiritual intelligence. That's kind of where I was going to go with that. So the theory here is that it's a huge challenge because so many people, well-meaning people who are just ordinary folks living their lives, they've never had a situation. If they think back to the time with their parents or their grandparents or something like this, the world's never been like this before. So, I mean, this really presents a really strange and peculiar brew of sort of moral, ethical question marks, which simply wasn't the case before. And so you're right. Again, you know, if some people, you know, I have a bunch of friends who are, by the way, very tightly connected to sort of the life extension and that whole thing. You know, can you live 500 years? I don't think we should, frankly. I think that's a really bad idea, but that's just my personal opinion.
Well,
and yet there will probably be a select few who will pay big money and go off to some foreign country, and, you know, they will pay the money and probably live to 300 or something because they know who to pay and how to do it. But, you know, again, this is another one of those dividing lines. It's one of those cosmopolitan things. I mean, there's a whole bunch of these. That's just one of them.
And let's just hope that person isn't John Tesh.
No comment.
That's all I'm going to say. If I could pass a rule, that would be my rule. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know why I'm picking on him. All right, but did you see the story real quickly? I got 10 seconds here. Did you see the story about the T-Rex and the chicken in science news?
Yes, actually, birds and dinosaurs, and yes, it's a giant chicken.
Okay.
I want
to come back to that because I want to talk about our trajectory in that way too next on Coast to Coast Live with Charles Ostman. We're talking with a historian of the future on C2C Live. We are thinking big picture tonight with Charles Ostman, historian of the future, lecturer, and the guy who's telling us what we can expect out of the next 25 years or so, how we could be prepared for it. And we're touching on a million topics in the meantime. We'll get to your calls coming up next hour. And we haven't forgotten about the conversation on spiritual intelligence. It's just that before we can get there, and how this scientist tells us that spiritual intelligence just might save us all, that we have to get to the idea that the T-Rex is really known today as the chicken, that the modern ancestor of the T-Rex is something akin to a frog or a newt, but more likely the chicken. And what that tells us about our future, too. Next, it's Coast to Coast Live. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with Charles Ostman, you know, I was just thinking about during the break, is if it really happens that E. Howard Hunt's son gives us an audio tape of E. Howard Hunt confessing to him how the JFK assassination was pulled off, wouldn't that be really trippy?
That would be one of the milestones of modern broadcast history. So the fact that I got to be on the very night that it sort of came to, I mean, you know, it's all kind of cool. It all fits together.
But you got to be bumped so that I can have that conversation.
You know, I will gladly, if that's the case, hey, move me over. It's okay. So here's a couple of quick thoughts. First of all, when you're talking about the chicken versus T-Rex, and by the way, this has actually been well established for a number of years. It just happened to make the news recently. But
Wait. I thought this part was new. And now you try me on this. For people that don't know the story, real quickly, USA Today ran it earlier this week talking about how for the first time, they were able to pull actual soft tissue from inside the bone of a T-Rex, which they had found 60 feet below some shale in Montana or something. And they had sandstone or something. And they pulled out this soft tissue, and they were able to determine that, genetically speaking, the type of proteins that were in this soft tissue were a match specifically to a chicken, which I thought was interesting because I've always heard this theory about, you know, dinosaurs becoming birds. That part wasn't so surprising. But the idea of the T-Rex becoming a chicken. No,
well, I was thinking, you know, remember the Flintstones cartoon when the beginning where it showed Fred Flintstone, they pull up to the drive and they have this giant stack of ribs and the car would fall over?
Exactly.
Now imagine instead they had a giant drumstick. I mean, I thought that was kind of my vision of the whole thing. But on a slightly more serious note, yeah, I mean, this is a big deal in the sense that we were able to find soft tissue. That's a big deal. But the lineage of the genealogy of birds being the sort of modern extension of dinosaurs, that's been a pretty well established theory
no,
for
I get that,
probably a decade or so. Roughly.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Jurassic Park. You know, I'm a guy who would go to, I mean, I know they've been talking about that for a long time. I guess the part that surprised me, though, is, and I, you know, we can't get in the mind of a chicken. Does the chicken still have some sort of, you know, genetic sense memory that at one time it was a T-Rex and how frustrating it is that nobody takes it seriously
the
as a chicken anymore?
Well, maybe that's why cockfights are so serious, because maybe that is the T-Rex coming along. But anyway,
But the trajectory of that is that something that was big and powerful and at one time was a terrible tyrant king is now a chicken. Is how do can we learn from that perhaps where
we might be headed? And in fact, that's actually interesting. I maybe jumped in a little too fast because, in a sense, what it does say is that life, the morphology of existence, should never be underestimated. What was once considered the top of the food chain could really become the plankton of tomorrow. I mean, that's kind of how that looks.
We have
lots of examples of this, by the way. You know, we are. This is the thing that I find so annoying about humans. If I can be so rude on the air, I guess, because I just as I you know, read history and study all different cultures and try to appreciate where they're coming from. You know, I really do. I try to get a sense of how has the human condition got to where it is. Some cultures have had a very beautiful, very balanced, very spiritually kind of, I don't know, better way, if I can use that clumsy set of words, to kind of at least sense, you know, how we fit into the larger scheme of things. Other paradigms, though, were much more myopic and, you know, saw us as the center of the universe and we're the supreme being and we're the, you know, image of God. What a bunch of crap. I mean, it's that kind of thinking that has really led us into, some very misleading false, you know, delusions of grandeur kind of visions. And in fact, that the point you just made is a really good one, because that's exactly right. We may be the life form they are at this particular moment, but that may not be what we'll be you know, a few millennia from now. And in fact,
we could end up being some sort of feral woodland creature, some tree-dwelling primate that lives, you know, in the crooks of pine trees and everybody makes fun of.
And it may well be that dolphins or something become the next, you know, dominant life form. It could be anything. So, I mean, that's 100% correct. In fact, if I could be so bold, on the next set of slides, I know PowerPoint and Danish is on. But anyway, I actually have this piece that comes from Ray Kurzweil from his Singularity work. And it kind of shows his vision of the six-set box of evolution. It's a little bit technical and kind of wordy, but it kind of suggests this exact concept in the sense that we're an evolving life form system, but, you know, he has one particular thread starting from something very simple to something sort of enhanced by this sort of co-evolutionary concept. But everything's in a state of flux. And, in fact, this is the one thing I wanted to lead into, if I may. Since in the last hour, he poked at me and said, well, Charles, what's new in the news? You know, what's the big new thing? Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about, besides Project Blue Brain and related things, was the crossing the boundary of synthetic life forms. Now, this is a really big deal. And I, the last time, in fact, I was on the air with you, we talked about it a little bit, and I was on the air with George. But I kind of kept trying to bring this point across, and I'm not sure it hit a lot of people, you know, as much as I thought it might. But back in December of 2005, in Canada, actually, the first published documentation, I have to underline that word carefully, about a truly artificial life form. And, you know, very simple. It was a kind of a protovirus. But, I mean, this was the first time ever that a laboratory, you know, a major medical laboratory, came out and said, yeah, we built this living thing. It's a fully synthetic organism. Now, since that time, the field of synthetic biology has really moved very fast. I mean, truly, it's really taken on a life of its own. Horrible pun, I'm sorry. But, I mean, in laboratories all over the world, people are very quickly getting this kind of a sort of a nanobiological approach to building life forms. In fact, there's even now a kind of an object-oriented life form system that's being developed where you can kind of mix and match different proteomic subunits and kind of blend them together to make the design of organism of choice. Now, people are asking, well, why is that relevant? Why is that interesting? Well, first of all, you know, the definition of life. It was always seen that this was somehow God's creation or that whatever occurs in nature, that's the boundary point. You know, we're here and then, you know, life is over there. Wrong answer, actually. We have now stepped into this territory where we actually can, in fact, fabricate life. Now, it may be very simple to start with, but I think you can see the logic of the path that's coming up around the corner, because before too long, we're going to start looking at how to synthetically, not just synthetically modify current organisms by genetically mixing and matching, you know, genetic material, but rather actually building organisms from scratch. That is the next new thing.
But how long until those things come looking for Sarah Connor?
Well, I mean, as one I'm sure can extrapolate, if we went down a particular narrow path where the mixing of tissue and machinery and, you know, kind of cyborgs for military apps, well, yeah, that could be one of them.
Well,
but I'm not sure it's going to go that way, but certainly any variety of possibilities does come up, and that boundary point was crossed a little over a year ago. That was my
But doesn't that go right back to what we were talking about last half hour? You know, here's science doing it because it can, and, you know, boundary points are, you know, marked along the line of the latest funding from whatever, you know, group the scientist is trying to get money from to keep the research going.
Let me tell you why this is being done. Maybe that may be helpful. And believe me, I bring this up not to scare people or get people to go, oh my gosh, this is craziness and panic, but rather to sort of get a sense of a larger scheme of things. So I will attempt at least to give that larger scheme. We're stepping into an area now where, because of climate change, because of massive population migrations, a whole bunch of reasons, we're seeing mutational vectors and epidemiological phenomena popping up in ways that really are very alarming to a lot of folks. My own personal experience may be a testament to that, I'm not sure. But the point is, we have several things on our plate at the same time. We're trying to deal with what seems to be an acceleration in the mutation factors of different viral entities. In other words, we have kind of like a catalog or a known range of organisms and the biopathogens associated with them, and we figure out how to neutralize or in some way inoculate against these things. But as the rate of mutation increases, and this is partly driven, by the way, by an overusage of different kinds of vaccines and different kinds of antibiotics, and, you know, a whole bunch of things which never happened, say, 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. In other words, all these things are sort of accelerating simultaneously. So the response is a much higher mutational vector, and we have a much more virulent and much more complex variety of microbes and things to deal with that we simply didn't know about. Okay, so now you map that against the potential for biowarfare, which sadly, I think really is kind of around the corner. It's kind of like the next thing that probably is going to be the major thing we're going to be facing. So a way to look at this is to say, okay, how can we best unravel these new things that we run into to understand what they are, maybe to even deal with them in some kind of proactive way? Well, one of the pathways to that point is to do precisely this, is to create or build or construct these artificial organisms, as a way to combat these things, and something else that's even of a larger value. And here it is, manufacturing. Now, just hold on for a sec. You're thinking, what's this guy talking about? Well, here we go. In the world of nano-fabricated materials, we have an enormous pressure on the planet now to produce all kinds of things, electronic circuits, you know, disposable cell phones. I mean, you name it. I mean, whether it's smart materials for your house or stuff that goes into your appliances or, you know, stuff that's part of your daily life, or, in many cases, extremely expensive and very hard to synthesize drugs, pharmaceuticals. What if, however, one could build a living thing, a foundry, a biofoundry, that instead of having to have some gigantic and very complex and very impactful system to create a new pharmaceutical drug, you could simply create an organism that could live in like a little petri dish, as it were, and that would just sort of grow the thing you're looking for. That's exactly where this is going.
Okay, yeah, it can grow that sort of thing until you feed it after midnight or you get it wet, and then it'll start growing in ways that, oh, well, we didn't see this coming. I mean, I'm with you.
Well, wait, I know where you're going, so let me toss in my thought. In a
you
controlled
do not
environment,
know where I'm going.
I'm going to try empathic probes just for a moment.
All right,
and then
go
we can
ahead.
Pass that. Okay, so the empathic probe, I think, looks like this. You're saying, okay, we turn this thing on, then it gets crazy and gets loose and something horrible happens. Well, part of that is partly true to a point. In other words, for the people I know personally and for the folks, the colleagues I've worked with and seen what they're doing, these folks are absolutely bent on doing things that have some kind of positive value, and they're very much looking at medical applications as their first target. In these situations, it's very tightly controlled. Nothing's floating around. It's not like that at all. However, the same exact tool system somewhere else in the world with a very different set of motives in mind could do exactly what you're saying. And here's where I'm going with this. If some nutcase out there, some lunatic, decides that they want to create a artificially contrived, ultra-virulent hunter virus that can be spread as an aerosol, like in tuberculosis, like some kind of weird mix between tuberculosis and hunter virus and hemorrhagic fever, you know, some god-awful nightmare microbe, and they try to design this thing in the hope that they could target all Jewish people or something, you know, some horrible, stupid idea. But then, of course, once they create this hideous thing, itself actually mutates and becomes something very different than these clowns even, you know, thought of. Yeah, that could be exactly what could happen. However, it would not be because of the medical folks who are trying to create a new way to make a better medical solution. It was really because of the parallel efforts that would sprout up somewhere else with a very different set of motives in mind.
This is too easy to even call it devil's advocacy. I don't even have to blame this on the devil. I'll say this is Ian advocacy. What do we say? Doing stuff for some greater good, some positive influence. Aren't we really talking about coming up with something that can be trademarked, something that can be copywritten, copyrighted, I guess would be, so that somebody has proprietary claim on it so that they can make money off it? I mean, scientists aren't turning out these medical devices or something so that it's free and available to all mankind. Somebody owns it and makes a ton of money off it for 7 years.
Well, actually, this is kind of complicated, and so I'm going to have to be a little careful here because part of my work also involves working with evil music in the background, venture capitalists, who are not necessarily the evil people of the planet. It's not quite
No, and I don't want you to lose your gig over this, but I mean, come on. I mean, it's not all about altruism. It's even for science, it's about control and money.
Well, partly yes and partly no, but please allow me just a minute to see if I can explain this better.
Of course.
In the upside, it takes a type of capitalist fuel system to drive these developments. And in other words, in a perfect world, the utopian world, everything should be free and beautiful. But, you know, this is not that way. So realistically, how this tends to go is scientists or a group of folks have developed what could be a very promising technique to make a new kind of drug, maybe very cheaply. And they do have to, however, raise a certain amount of funds to even get to that certain point. And then whoever decides to take on the B and C rounds to sort of support the development to its commercialization endpoint, they have to see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel to justify that development. Now, actually, what is happening is in various parts of the world, like India, for instance, different economic models are coming to pass. And it may well be, and I think that we're at a very interesting evolutionary threshold as we speak, the concept of intellectual property extending to things like living organisms. This is a real big hot potato. It's a very yet-to-be-defined, iffy proposition. And, in fact, one of the really delicate areas is that it's not even so much the chemistry or the physical thing. It's actually the software. It's actually the algorithms or the procedures that led up to the thing. That's actually where the real intellectual property is. So this becomes a kind of a dicey thing to try to codify in a short way. However, the flip side of this coin says the following thing. I completely agree with you that if we get to a point, like, let's look at genetically modified food. This is a real touchy issue. Monsanto, you know, corn, I mean, et cetera. Now, there's some people who theorize that because of the pressure to create these seeds, where you have to buy a new set of seeds every year.
Right,
because
they do not
reproduce. People have actually been sued because they found some, you know, self-pollinating seeds on their land that wasn't paid for the right way. There's actually a theory going around that this may be the what's causing the bees to be killed off.
Because, we've talked about that on the show. Oh,
yeah,
without a doubt.
And good for you, because I think it's a very serious topic. Now, it turns out that we've wiped out a good portion of the Earth's bee population because of these idiots at Monsanto that tried to capitalize on making people buy their seeds. This would be an unbelievable crime on a global scale. These guys should go to prison for life and never get out.
And
because if we kill off the bees, we're toast. I mean, life's going to end very quickly.
But proving that would be nearly impossible.
It would be the ultimate legal battle of all time. It would probably stretch for 20 years, and by that time we may be starving. So who knows? I mean, this is a good snapshot. I mean, I'm glad you brought this up because it's something I really do want to try to get people to think about.
These are exactly
the kinds of delicate balancing acts that we're being sort of pressed to try to understand.
If any of these guys from Monsanto ever went to jail, it would be the kind of jail where, in the words of my friend Jim, where a penalty for these guys behind bars would mean that they have to swing off the ladies' tee. So, I mean, it's not exactly like any of these executives and any of these companies that are rolling the dice on these biotech patents, that they're really worried about any kind of repercussions, because it just isn't going to happen. And that brings me back to my point from before, though, is that, you know, here we're talking about whatever, let's call the product Nano Nanny, and it's this new nano bio piece that's going to come in and eat phones and make phones disposable or something. And
it it's not quite exactly how it would go. Basically, you know, it's a rough analogy.
Okay, but the always altruistic, you know, humanitarian scientists who come up with this stuff for a price aren't the ones ultimately down the line that control the rights to it.
Let me give you a flip side of this coin, because this is a great debate. And this is the reason I go on the air. And thank you, Ian, because this is perfect. You're doing exactly what I was hoping to do.
I've fallen into your evil trap once more.
The evil traps, yes, the door flies open. Okay, but before I fall into these spear tips down below, here's what I'm trying to get at. There's something called bioremediation. I've had some very, very good friends of mine who are really the absolute best kind of scientists, who are as well-meaning as anybody could be. Their vision is, can we use organisms to eat up waste in sludge ponds? You know, if you go to places like Africa and parts of Asia, you have got some of the worst, most miserable, I mean truly horrible, beyond your imagination, scenarios where you've got indigenous people surrounded by these giant piles of refuse and these sludge ponds because there's no regulations. And so a lot of these Western companies dump all their crap over there. It's really awful. I mean, it's truly awful. And so yet, is there a solution? Well, one solution could be using organisms that have been modified a little bit that actually go in and separate out the toxic materials and even can harvest a lot of the heavy metals and other materials from these sludge pits and, in fact, neutralize the toxicity and at the same time produce a profitable product. That, I think, is a good thing. It's a biological solution for an otherwise unsolvable problem.
It always looks good on paper.
Actually,
and then the T-Rex is stomping through downtown San Diego.
Well, maybe he should be for different reasons. But,
okay.
But I'm just saying there's always two ways to look at this.
I agree. And then I agree with you. I mean, I know what you're saying. But then there's this other part of me that sings, I knew an old lady who swallowed a fly. And, you know, somewhere along the line here, I have to ask you a question about science next and the future of our planet. Charles Ostman, looking into his crystal ball. How about you? You want to join in this conversation? We'll shoot you all the numbers you need coming up next. But I want to pull a little bit more at that religion versus science thread and what we can fear and or look forward to next on Coast to Coast Live.